Nothing, replied the Jewess. All about him is black as the wing of the night raven. Nothing can I spy that may mark him further. But having once seen him put forth his strength in battle, methinks I could know him again among a thousand warriors. He rushes to the fray as if he were summoned to a banquet. There is more than mere strength. There seems as if the whole soul and spirit of the champion were given to every blow which he deals upon his enemies. God assuage him of the sin of bloodshed. It is fearful yet magnificent to behold how the arm and heart of one man can triumph over hundreds. Rebecca, said Ivanhoe, thou hast painted a hero. Surely they rest but to refresh their force, or to purvey the means of crossing the moat. Under such a leader as thou hast spoken this knight to be, there are no craven fears, no cold-blooded delays, no yielding up a gallant emprise, since the difficulties which render it arduous render it also glorious. I swear by the honour of my house, I vow by the name of my bright lady-love, I would endure 10 years of captivity to fight for one day by that good knight's side in such a quarrel as this. Alas, said Rebecca, leaving her station at the window and approaching the couch of the wounded knight, this impatient yearning after action, this struggling with and repining at your present weakness, will not fail to injure your returning health. How couldst thou hope to inflict wounds on others, ere that be healed which thou thyself hast received? Rebecca, he replied, thou knowest not how impossible it is for one trained to actions of chivalry to remain passive as a priest or a woman when they are acting deeds of honour around him. The love of battle is the food upon which we live. The dust of the melee is the breath of our nostrils. We live not, we wish to live no longer than while we are victorious and renowned. Such, maiden, are the laws of chivalry to which we are sworn, and to which we offer all that we hold dear. Alas, said the fair Jewess, and what is it, valiant knight, save an offering of sacrifice to a demon of vainglory, and a passing through the fire to Moloch? What remains to you as the prize of all the blood you have spilled, of all the travail and pain you have endured, of all the tears which your deeds have caused, when death hath broken the strong man's spear and overtaken the speed of his war-horse? What remains? Echoed Ivanhoe. Glory, maiden, glory, which gilds our sepulchre and embalms our name. Glory, continued Rebecca, alas, is the rusted mail which hangs as a hatchment over the champion's dim and mouldering tomb. Is the defaced sculpture of the inscription, which the ignorant monk can hardly read to the inquiring pilgrim, are these sufficient rewards for the sacrifice of every kindly affection, for a life spent miserably that you make others miserable? Or is there such virtue in the rude rhymes of a wandering bard, that domestic love, kindly affection, peace and happiness are so wildly bartered to become the hero of these ballads which vagabond minstrels sing to drunken churls over their evening ale? By the soul of Hereward, replied the knight impatiently, thou speakest, maiden, of thou knowest not what. Thou wouldst quench the pure light of chivalry, which alone distinguishes the noble from the base, the gentle knight from the churl and the savage, which rates our life far, far beneath the pitch of our honour, raises us victorious over pain, toil, and suffering, and teaches us to fear no evil but disgrace. Thou art no Christian, Rebecca, and to thee are unknown those high feelings which swell the bosom of a noble maiden when her lover hath done some deed of emprise which sanctions his flame. Chivalry, why, maiden, it is the nurse of pure and high affection, the stay of the oppressed, the redresser of grievances, the curb of the power of the tyrant. Nobility were but an empty name without her, and liberty finds the best protector in her lance and sword. I am indeed, said Rebecca, sprung from a race whose courage was distinguished in the defence of their own land, but who warred not, even while yet a nation, save at the command of the deity, or in defending their country from oppression. The sound of the trumpet wakes Judah no longer, and her dispersed children are now but the unresisting victims of hostile and military oppression. Well hast thou spoken, Sir Knight. Until the God of Jacob shall raise up for his chosen people a second Gideon or a new Maccabeus, it ill beseemeth the Jewish damsel to speak of battle or of war. The high-minded maiden concluded the argument in a tone of sorrow, which deeply expressed her sense of the degradation of her people, embittered perhaps by the idea that Ivanhoe considered her as one not entitled to entertain or capable of expressing sentiments of honour and generosity. "How little he knows this bosom," she said, "to imagine that cowardice and meanness of soul must needs be its guests, because I have censured the fantastic chivalry of the Nazarenes. Would to heaven that the shedding of mine own blood, drop by drop, could redeem the captivity of Judah. Nay, would to God it could avail to set free my father, and this his benefactor, from the chains of the oppressor. The proud Christian should then see whether the daughter of God's chosen people dared not to die as bravely as the proudest Nazarene maiden that boasts her descent from some petty chieftain of the rude and frozen north." She then looked towards the couch of the wounded knight. "He sleeps," she said. "Nature exhausted by sufferance and by the waste of spirits. His wearied frame embraces the first moment of temporary relaxation to sink into slumber. Alas, is it a crime that I should look upon him, when it may be for the last time, when yet but a short space, and those fair features will be no longer animated by the bold and buoyant spirit which forsakes them not even in sleep, when the nostrils shall be distended, the mouth agape, the eyes fixed and bloodshot, and when the proud and noble knight may be trodden on by the lowest caitiff of this accursed castle, yet stir not when the heel is lifted up against him. And my father, oh, my father, evil is it with his daughter, when his grey hairs are not remembered because of the golden locks of youth. What know I but that these evils are the messengers of Jehovah's wrath to the unnatural child who thinks of a stranger's captivity before a parent's, who forgets the desolation of Judah, and looks upon the comeliness of a Gentile and a stranger. But I will tear this folly from my heart, though every fibre bleed as I rend it away." She wrapped herself closely in her veil, and sat down at a distance from the couch of the wounded knight, with her back turned towards it, fortifying, or endeavouring to fortify, her mind not only against the impending evils from without, but also against those treacherous feelings which assailed her from within. Chapter 16. Approach the chamber, look upon his bed. His is the passing of no peaceful ghost, which, as the lark arises to the sky, mid-morning's sweetest breeze and softest dew, is winged to heaven by good men's sighs and tears. Anselm parts otherwise. Old Play. During the interval of quiet which followed the first success of the besiegers, while the one party was preparing to follow their advantage and the other to strengthen their means of defence, the Templar and de Bracy held brief counsel together in the hall of the castle. "Where is Front de Boeuf?" said the latter, who had superintended the defence of the fortress on the other side. "Men say he hath been slain." "He lives," said the Templar coolly. "Lives as yet. But had he worn the bull's head of which he bears the name, and 10 plates of iron to fence it withal, he must have gone down before yonder fatal axe. Yet a few hours, and Front de Boeuf is with his fathers. A powerful limb lopped off Prince John's enterprise. And a brave addition to the kingdom of Satan," said de Bracy. "This comes of reviling saints and angels, and ordering images of holy things and holy men to be flung down on the heads of these rascai yeomen." "Go to, thou art a fool," said the Templar. "Thy superstition is upon a level with Front de Boeuf's want of faith. Neither of you can render a reason for your belief or unbelief." "Benedicite, Sir Templar," replied de Bracy, "I pray you to keep better rule with your tongue when I am the theme of it. By the Mother of Heaven, I am a better Christian man than thou and thy fellowship, for the brie goeth shrewdly out that the most holy order of the Temple of Zion nurseth not a few heretics within its bosom, and that Sir Brian de Bois-Guilbert is of the number." "Care not thou for such reports,"
said the Templar, but let us think of making good the castle. How fought these villain yeomen on thy side?
Like fiends incarnate, said de Bracy. They swarmed close up to the walls, headed, as I think, by the knave who won the prize at the archery, for I knew his horn and baldric. And this is old Fitzurse's boasted policy, encouraging these malapert knaves to rebel against us. Had I not been armed in proof, the villain had marked me down 7 times with as little remorse as if I had been a buck in season. He told every rivet on my armour with a cloth-yard shaft that rapped against my ribs with as little remorse as if my bones had been of iron. But that I wore a shirt of Spanish mail under my plate coat, I had been fairly sped.
But you maintained your post, said the Templar. We lost the outwork on our part.
That is a shrewd loss, said de Bracy. The knaves will find cover there to assault the castle more closely, and may, if not well watched, gain some unguarded corner of a tower or some forgotten window, and so break in upon us. Our numbers are too few for the defence of every point, and the men complain that they can nowhere show themselves, but they're a mark for as many arrows as a parish butt on a holy day even. Front de Boeuf is dying too, so we shall receive no more aid from his bull's head and brutal strength. How think you, Sir Brian? Were we not better make a virtue of necessity and compound with the rogues by delivering up our prisoners?
How? Exclaimed the Templar. Deliver up our prisoners, and stand an object alike of ridicule and execration, as the doughty warriors who dared by a night attack to possess themselves of the persons of a party of defenceless travellers, yet could not make good a strong castle against a vagabond troop of outlaws, led by swineherds, jesters, and the very refuse of mankind. Shame on thy counsel, Maurice de Bracy. The ruins of this castle shall bury both my body and my shame, ere I tamely consent to such base and dishonourable composition.
Let us to the walls, then, said de Bracy carelessly. That man never breathed, be he Turk or Templar, who holds life at lighter rate than I do. But I trust there is no dishonour in wishing I had here some 20 of my gallant troop of free companions. Ah, my brave lances, if you knew but how hard your captain was this day bestad, how soon would I see my banner at the head of your clump of spears, and how short while would these rabble villains stand to endure your encounter?
Wish for whom thou wilt, said the Templar, but let us make what defence we can with the soldiers who remain. They are chiefly Front de Boeuf's followers, hated by the English for 1,000 acts of insolence and oppression.
The better, replied de Bracy. The rugged slaves will defend themselves to the last drop of blood ere they encounter the vengeance of the peasants without. Let us up and be doing, then, Brian de Bois-Guilbert. And, live or die, thou shalt see Maurice de Bracy bear himself this day as a gentleman of blood and lineage.
To the walls, answered the Templar,
and they both ascended the battlements to do all which skill could dictate and manhood accomplish in defence of the place. They readily agreed that the point of greatest danger was that opposite to the outwork, of which the assailants had possessed themselves. The castle, indeed, was divided from that barbican by the moat, and it was impossible that the besiegers could assail the postern door, with which the outwork corresponded, without surmounting that obstacle. But it was the opinion both of the Templar and de Bracy that they would endeavour, by a formidable assault, to draw the chief part of the defenders' observations to this point, and take measures to avail themselves of every negligence which might take place in the defence elsewhere. To guard against such an evil, their numbers only permitted the knights to place sentinels from space to space along the walls in communication with each other, who might give the alarm whenever danger was threatened. Meanwhile, they agreed that de Bracy should command the defence of the postern, and the Templar should keep with him 40 men or thereabouts as a body of reserve, ready to rush to any other point which might be suddenly threatened. The loss of the barbican had also this unfortunate effect, that, notwithstanding the superior height of the castle walls, the besieged could not see from them, with the same precision as before, the operations of the enemy, for some straggling underwood approached so near the sally-port of the outwork that the assailants might introduce into it whatever force they thought proper, not only under cover, but even without the knowledge of the defenders. Utterly uncertain, therefore, upon what point the storm was to burst,
De Bracy and his companion were under the necessity of providing against every possible contingence, and their followers, however brave, experienced the anxious dejection of mind incident to men enclosed by enemies who possessed the power of choosing their time and mode of attack. Meanwhile, the lord of the beleaguered and endangered castle lay upon a bed of bodily pain and mental agony. He had not the usual resource of bigots in that superstitious period, most of whom were wont to atone for the crimes they were guilty of by liberality to the church, stupefying by this means their remorse by the idea of atonement and forgiveness. And although the repose which sinners thus purchased no more resembled the peace of mind which follows on sincere repentance than the turbid stupefaction procured by opium resembles healthy and natural slumbers, it was still a state of mind preferable to the agonies of awakened remorse. But among the vices of Front de Boeuf, a hard and gripple man, avarice was predominant, and he preferred setting church and churchmen at defiance to purchasing from them pardon and absolution at the price of treasure and of manners. Nor did the Templar, an infidel of another stamp, justly characterize his associate when he said Front de Boeuf could assign no cause for his unbelief and contempt for the established faith, for the Baron would have alleged that the church sold her wares too dear, that the spiritual freedom which she put up to sale was only to be bought, like that of the chief captain at Jerusalem, with a great sum, and Front de Boeuf preferred denying the virtue of the medicine to paying the expense of the physician. But the moment had now arrived when earth and all its treasures were gliding from before his eyes, and when his heart, though hard as a nether millstone, became appalled as he gazed forward into the waste darkness of futurity. The fever of his body aided the impatience and agony of his mind, and his deathbed exhibited a mixture of the newly awakened feelings of remorse, combating with the fixed and inveterate reprobacy of his disposition, a fearful state of mind only to be equalled in those tremendous regions where there are complaints without hope, remorse without repentance, a horrid sense of present agony, and a presentiment that it cannot cease or be diminished.
"Where be these dog priests now?" growled the Baron. "Who set such price on their ghostly mummery? Where be all those unshod Carmelites?" for whom old Front de Boeuf founded the convent of St. Anne's, robbing his heir of many a fair rood of meadow and many a fat field and close. Where be the greedy hounds now? Swilling, I warrant me, at the ale, or playing their juggling tricks at the bedside of some miserly churl. Me, the heir of their founder, me, whom their foundation binds them to pray for, me, ungrateful villains as they are! They suffer to die like the houseless hare on yonder common, unshriven and unhouseled. Tell the Templar to come hither. He is a priest and may do something, but no. As well confess myself to the devil as to Brion de Bois-Guilbert, who recks neither of heaven nor of hell. I have heard old men talk of prayer. Prayer by their own voice, such need not to court or to bribe the false priests, but I dare not.
Lives Reginald Front de Boeuf,
said a broken yet shrill voice close to his bedside,
to say there is that which he dares not.
The evil conscience and the shaken nerves of Front de Boeuf heard, in this strange interruption to his soliloquy, the voice of one of those demons who, as the superstition of the times believed, beset the beds of dying men to distract their thoughts and turn them from the meditations and duties which concerned their eternal welfare. He shuddered and drew himself together, but, instantly summoning up his wonted resolution, exclaimed,
"Who is there? What art thou that darest to echo my words in a tone like that of the night raven? Come before my couch that I may see thee."
"I am thine evil angel, Reginald Front de Boeuf," replied the voice.
"Let me behold thee, then, in thy bodily shape. If thou beest indeed a fiend," replied the dying knight, "think not that I will blench from thee. By the eternal dungeon, could I but grapple with these horrors that hover around me as I have done with mortal dangers, heaven nor hell should say that I shrunk from the conflict.
Think on thy sins, Reginald Front de Boeuf, on rebellion, on murder, on rapine. Who stirred up the licentious John to war against his grey-headed father, against his generous
man or fiend, priest or devil? Replied Front de Boeuf. Thou liest in thy throat. Not I stirred John to rebellion, not I alone. There were 50 knights and barons, the flower of the Midland counties. Better men never laid lance in rest, and must I answer for the fault done by 50? False fiend, I defy thee. Depart, and haunt my couch no more. Let me die in peace if thou be mortal. If thou be indeed a demon, thy time is not yet come.
In peace thou shalt not die, repeated the voice. Even in death shalt thou think on thy murders, on the groans which this castle has echoed, on the blood that is ingrained in its walls.
Thou canst not shake me by thy petty malice, answered Front de Boeuf with a ghastly and constrained laugh. The infidel Jew! It was merit with heaven to deal with him as I did, else wherefore are men canonized who dip their hands in the blood of Saracens? The Saxon porkers, whom I have slain, they were the foes of my country, and of my lineage, and of my liege lord. Ha! Ha! Thou seest there is no crevice in my coat of plate. Art thou fled? Art thou silenced?
No, foul parricide, replied the voice. Think of thy father. Think of his death. Think of his banquet room flooded with his gore, and by the hand of a son.
Nay, answered the baron, after a long pause, and thou knowest that. Thou art indeed the author of evil, and as omniscient as the monks call thee. That secret I deemed locked in my own breast, and in that of one beside. The temptress, the partaker of my guilt. Go, leave me, fiend, and seek the Saxon witch Ulrica, who alone could tell thee what she and I alone witnessed. Go, I say, to her who washed the wounds and straighted the corpse, and gave to the slain man the outward show of one parted in time and in the course of nature. Go to her. She was my temptress, the foul provoker, the more foul rewarder of the deed. Let her, as well as I, taste of the tortures which anticipate hell.
She already tastes them, said Ulrica, stepping before the couch of Front de Boeuf. She hath long drunken of this cup, and its bitterness is sweetened to see that thou dost partake it. Grind not thy teeth, Front de Boeuf. Roll not thine eyes. Clench not thy hand, nor shake it at me with that gesture of menace. The hand which this morning could, like that of the renowned ancestor who gained thy name, have broken with one stroke the skull of a mountain bull, is now unnerved and powerless as mine own. Vile, murderous hag, replied Front de Boeuf. Detestable screech owl! Is it then thou art come to exult over the ruins thou hast assisted to lay low?
Aye, Reginald Front de Boeuf, answered she. It is Ulrica. It is the daughter of the murdered Torquil Wolfganger. It is the sister of his slaughtered sons. It is she who demands of thee and of thy father's house, father and kindred, name and fame, body and soul, all that she has lost by the name of Front de Boeuf. Think of my wrongs, Front de Boeuf, and answer me if I speak not truth. Thou hast been my evil angel, and I will be thine. I will dog thee till the very instant of dissolution.
Detestable fury, answered Front de Boeuf. That moment shalt thou never witness. Ho, Gilles, Clément, and Eustace! Samour and Stephen, seize this damned witch and hurl her from the battlements headlong. She has betrayed us to the Saxon. Ho, Samour, Clément, false-hearted knaves, where tarry ye?
Call on them again, valiant baron, said the hag with a smile of grisly mockery.
Summon thy vassals around thee. Doom them that loiter to the scourge and the dungeon. But no, mighty chief," she continued, suddenly changing her tone, "thou shalt have neither answer nor aid nor obedience at their hands. Listen to these horrid sounds."
For the din of the recommenced assault and defence now rung fearfully loud from the battlements of the castle.
"In that war cry is the downfall of thy house. The blood-cemented fabric of Front de Boeuf's power totters to the foundation, and before the foes he most despised, the Saxon Reginald, the scorned Saxon, assails thy walls. Why liest thou here like a worn-out hind when the Saxon storms thy place of strength?"
"Gods and fiends!" exclaimed the wounded knight. "Oh, for one moment's strength, to drag myself to the melee and perish as becomes my name."
"Think not of it, valiant warrior," replied she. "Thou shalt die no soldier's death, but perish like a fox in his den when peasants have set fire to the cover around it."
"Hateful hag, thou liest," exclaimed Front de Boeuf. "My followers bear them bravely. My walls are strong and high. My comrades-at-arms fear not a whole host of Saxons, whether headed by Hengist and Horsa. The war-cry of the Templar and of the Free Companions rises high over the conflict, and, by mine honour, when we kindle the blazing beacon for joy of our defence, it shall consume thee, body and bones, and I shall live to hear thou art gone from earthly fires to those of that hell which never sent forth an incarnate fiend more utterly diabolical."
"Hold thy belief," replied Ulrica, "till the proof teach thee. But no," she said, interrupting herself, "thou shalt know even now the doom which all thy power, strength, and courage is unable to avert, though it is prepared for thee by this feeble hand. Markest thou the smouldering and suffocating vapour which already eddies in sable folds through the chamber? Didst thou think it was but the darkening of thy bursting eyes, the difficulty of thy combat breathing? No, Front de Boeuf, there is another cause. Rememberest thou not the magazine of fuel that is stored beneath these apartments?"
"Woman!" he exclaimed with fury, "thou hast not set fire to it! By heaven, thou hast! And the castle is in flames!"
"They are fast rising, at least," said Ulrica with frightful composure, "and a signal shall soon wave to warn the avengers to press hard those who would extinguish them. Farewell, Front de Boeuf. May Mista, Skogula, and Zernebock, gods of the ancient Saxons, fiends, as the priests now call them, supply the place of comforters at your dying bed, which Ulrica now relinquishes. Yet know, if it will give thee comfort to know it, that Ulrica is bound to the same dark coast with thyself, the companion of thy punishment as the companion of thy guilt. And now, parricide! Farewell for ever. May each stone of this vaulted roof find a tongue to echo that title into thine ear."
So saying, she left the apartment, and Front de Boeuf could hear the crash of the ponderous key as she locked and double-locked the door behind her, thus cutting off the most slender chance of escape. In the extremity of agony, he shouted upon his servants and allies,
"Stephen and Sigmore, Clément and Gilles, I burn here unaided. To the rescue! To the rescue, brave Bois Guilbert, valiant de Brassy! It is Front de Boeuf who calls. It is your master, ye traitor squires, your ally, your brother-in-arms, ye perjured and faithless knights. All the curses due to traitors upon your recreant heads. Do you abandon me to perish thus miserably? Hear me not. I cannot hear me. My voice is lost in the din of battle. The smoke rolls thicker and thicker. The fire has caught upon the floor below. Oh, for one draught of the air of heaven, were it to be purchased by instant annihilation!"
And, in the mad frenzy of despair, the wretch now shouted with the shouts of the fighters, now muttered curses on himself, on mankind, and on heaven itself.
"The red fire flashes through the thick smoke!" he exclaimed. "The demon marches against me under the banner of his own element! Foul spirit, avoid! I go not with thee without my comrades! All are thine that garrison these walls! Thinkest thou Front de Boeuf will be singled out to go alone? No, the infidel Templar, the licentious de Bracy, Ulrica, the foul-murthering strumpet, the men who aided my enterprises, the dog Saxons and accursed Jews who are my prisoners, all shall attend me. A goodly fellowship as ever took the downward road." And he laughed in his frenzy till the vaulted roof rung again. "Who laughed there?" exclaimed Front de Boeuf in altered mood, for the noise of the conflict did not prevent the echoes of his own frenzied laughter from returning upon his ear. "Who laughed there? Ulrica, was it thou? Speak, witch, and I forgive thee, for only thou or the fiend of hell himself could have laughed at such a moment. Avaunt! Avaunt!" But it were impious to trace any farther the picture of the blasphemer and parricide's deathbed. End of Volume 2. Volume 3. Chapter 1. "Once more unto the breach, dear friends, once more, or close the wall up with our English dead. And you, good yeomen, whose limbs were made in England, show us here the metal of your pasture. Let us swear that you are worth your breeding." King Henry V. Cedric, after his liberation from captivity, was received with loud shouts of gratulation by the friendly bands which had assembled for his assistance and for that of his companions in misfortune. But the emergency did not leave time for much greeting, and he was quickly engaged with the principal leaders of the besiegers in serious discussion of the measures which were to be adopted. The Saxon failed not, by every argument he could suggest, to encourage the others to persevere in the attack on the place. He described the hazardous position of those whom he had left in the power of Front de Boeuf and his confederates, and, although not greatly confiding in Ulrica's message, omitted not to communicate her promise to the Black Knight and Locksley. They were well pleased to find that they had a friend within the place who might, in the moment of need, be able to facilitate their entrance, and readily agreed with the Saxon that a storm, under whatever disadvantages, ought to be attempted, as the only means of liberating the prisoners now in the hands of the cruel Front de Boeuf.
"The royal blood of Alfred is endangered," said Cedric.
"The honour of a noble lady is in peril," said the Black Knight. "And by the St. Christopher at my baldric," said the good yeoman, "were there no other cause than the safety of that poor faithful knave Womba, I would jeopard a joint ere a hair of his head were hurt."
"And so would I," said the friar. "What, sirs, are we not all born to be clerks? I trust well that a fool, I mean, do you see me, sirs, a fool that is free of his guild and master of his craft, and with all his jests, jibes, and quiddities, can give as much relish and savour to a cup of wine as ever a flitch of bacon can. I say, brethren, such a fool shall never want a wise clerk to pray for or fight for him at a strait, while I can say a mass or flourish a partisan."
And with that he made his heavy halbert to play around his head as a shepherd boy flourishes his little crook.
"True, holy clerk," said the Black Knight, "true as if St. Dunstan himself had said it. And now, good Locksley, were it not well that noble Cedric should assume the direction of this assault?"
"Not a jot, I," returned Cedric. "I have never been wont to study either how to take in or how to hold out those abodes of tyrannic power which the Normans have erected in this groaning land. I will fight among the foremost, but my honest neighbours well know I am not a trained soldier in the discipline of wars or the attack of strongholds."
"Since it stands thus with noble Cedric," said Locksley, "I am most willing to take on me the direction of the archery, and ye shall hang me up on my own trysting tree
and the defenders be permitted to show themselves over the walls without being stuck with as many shafts as there are cloves and a gammon of bacon at Christmas.
"Well said, stout yeoman, for the honour of the longbow," said the Black Knight. "And if I be thought worthy to have a charge in this matter, and can find among these brave men as many as are willing to follow a true knight, for so I may call myself, I am ready, with such skill as my experience has taught me, to lead them to the attack of these walls."
The parts being thus distributed to the leaders, they commenced the first assault, of which the reader already has heard the issue. When the barbican was carried, the Sable Knight sent notice of the happy event to Locksley, requesting him at the same time to keep such an observation on the castle as might prevent the defenders from combining their force for a sudden sally and recovering the outwork that they had lost. This the knight was chiefly desirous of avoiding, conscious that the men whom he led, being hasty and untrained voluntaries, imperfectly armed and unaccustomed to discipline, must upon any sudden attack fight at great disadvantage with the veteran soldiers of the Norman knights, who are well provided with arms both defensive and offensive, and who, to match the zeal and high spirit of the besiegers, had all the confidence which arises from perfect discipline and the habitual use of weapons. The knight employed this interval in causing to be constructed a sort of floating bridge or long raft, by means of which he hoped to cross the moat in despite of the resistance of the enemy. This was a work of some time, which the leaders the less regretted, as it gave Ulrica time to execute her plan of a diversion in their favour, whatever that might be. But when the raft was completed,
"It avails not waiting here longer," said the Black Knight.
"The sun is descending to the west, and I have that upon my hands which will not permit me to tarry with you another day. Besides, it is a marvel if the horsemen come not upon us from York, unless we speedily accomplish our purpose. Wherefore, one of you go to Locksley and bid him commence a discharge of arrows on the opposite side of the castle, and move forward as if about to assault it. And you, true English hearts, stand by me, and be ready to thrust the raft endlong across the moat whenever the postern on our side is thrown open. Follow me boldly across, and aid me to burst yon sallyport in the main wall of the castle. As many of you as like not this service, or are but ill-armed to meet it, do you man the top of the outwork, draw your bowstrings to your ears, and mind you quell with your shot whatever shall appear to man the rampart. Noble Cedric, wilt thou take the direction of those which remain?"
"Not so, by the soul of Hereward," said the Saxon. "Lead I cannot, but may posterity curse me in my grave if I follow not with the foremost wherever thou shalt point the way. The quarrel is mine, and well it becomes me to be in the van of the battle."
"Yet bethink thee, noble Saxon," said the knight, "thou hast neither hauberk nor corslet nor aught but that light helmet, target, and sword."
"The better," answered Cedric. "I shall be the lighter to climb these walls, and forgive the boast, sir knight, thou shalt this day see the naked breast of a Saxon as boldly presented to the battle as ever ye beheld the steel corslet of a Norman."
"In the name of God, then," said the knight, "fling open the door and launch the floating bridge." The portal, which led from the inner wall of the barbican to the moat, and which corresponded with a sallyport in the main wall of the castle, was now suddenly opened. The temporary bridge was then thrust forward, and soon flashed in the waters, extending its length between the castle and outwork, and furnishing a slippery and precarious passage for two men abreast to cross the moat. Well aware of the importance of taking the foe by surprise, the Black Knight, closely followed by Cedric, threw himself upon the bridge and reached the opposite side. Here he began to thunder with his axe on the gate of the castle, protected in part from the shot and stones cast by the defenders by the ruins of the former drawbridge, which the Templar had demolished in his retreat from the barbican, leaving the counterpoise still attached to the upper part of the portal. The followers of the knight had no such shelter. Two were instantly shot with crossbow bolts, and two more fell into the moat. The others retreated back into the barbican.
The situation of Cedric and of the Black Knight was now truly dangerous, and would have been still more so but for the constancy of the archers and the barbican, who ceased not to shower their arrows upon the battlements, distracting the attention of those by whom they were manned, and thus affording a respite to their two chiefs from the storm of missiles by which they must have been otherwise overwhelmed. But their situation was eminently perilous, and was becoming more so with every moment.
"Shame on you all!" cried de Bracy to the soldiers around him. "Do you call yourselves crossbowmen, and let these two dogs keep their station under the walls of the castle? Heave over the coping-stones from the battlements, and better may not be. Get pickaxe and levers, and down with that huge pinnacle!" pointing to a heavy piece of stone carved work that projected from the parapet. At this moment, the besiegers caught sight of the red flag upon the angle of the tower which Ulrica had described to Cedric. The good yeoman Locksley was the first who was aware of it, as he was hasting to the outwork, impatient to see the progress of the assault. "St. George!" he cried. "Merry St. George for England! To the charge, bold yeoman! Why leave you the good knight and the noble Cedric to storm the pass alone? Make in, mad priest! Show thou canst fight for thy rosary! Make in, brave yeoman! The castle is ours! We have friends within! See yonder flag! It is the appointed signal! Torquilstone is ours! Think of honour! Think of spoil! One effort, and the place is ours!" With that, he bent his good bow and sent a shaft right through the breast of one of the men-at-arms, who, under de Bracy's direction, was loosening a fragment from one of the battlements to precipitate on the heads of Cedric and the Black Knight. A second soldier caught from the hands of the dying man the iron crow, with which he heaved at and had loosened the stone pinnacle, when, receiving an arrow through his headpiece, he dropped from the battlements into the moat a dead man. The men-at-arms were daunted, for no armour seemed proof against the shot of this tremendous archer.
"Do you give ground, base knaves?" said de Bracy. "Montjoy Saint-Denis, give me the lever!"
And snatching it up, he again assailed the loosened pinnacle, which was of weight enough, if thrown down, not only to have destroyed the remnant of the drawbridge, which sheltered the two foremost assailants, but also to have sunk the rude float of planks over which they had crossed. All saw the danger, and the boldest, even the stout friar himself, avoided setting foot on the raft. Thrice did Locksley bend his shaft against de Bracy, and thrice did his arrow bound back from the knight's armour of proof.
"A curse on thy Spanish steel coat," said Locksley. "Had English smith forged it, these arrows had gone through, and as it had been silk or sendal."
He then began to call out,
"Comrades, friends, noble Cedric, bear back and let the ruin fall."
His warning voice was unheard, for the din which the knight himself occasioned by his strokes on the postern would have drowned 20 war trumpets. The faithful Girth indeed sprung forwards on the planked bridge to warn Cedric of his impending fate, or to share it with him, but his warning would have come too late. The massive pinnacle already tottered, and de Bracy would have accomplished his purpose had not the voice of the Templar sounded in his ear.
"All is lost, de Bracy. The castle burns."
"Thou art mad to say so," replied the knight.
"It is all in a light flame on the western side. I have striven in vain to extinguish it."
With the stern coolness which formed the basis of his character, Briand de Bois-Guilbert communicated this hideous intelligence, which was not so calmly received by his astounded comrade.
"Saints of paradise," said de Bracy, "what is to be done? I vow to Saint Nicolas of Limoges a candlestick of pure gold."
"Spare thy vow," said the Templar, "and mark me. Lead thy men down, as if to a sally. Throw the postern gate open. There are but two men who occupy the float. Fling them into the moat, and push across for the barbican. I will sally from the main gate and attack the barbican on the outside, and if we can regain that post, be assured we shall defend ourselves until we are relieved, or at least they grant us fair quarter."
"It is well thought upon," said de Bracy.
"I will play my part. Templar, thou wilt not fail me."
"Hand and glove I will not," said Bois-Guilbert, "but haste thee, in the name of God!"
De Bracy hastily drew his men together and rushed down to the postern gate, which he caused instantly to be thrown open. But scarce was this done, ere the portentous strength of the Black Knight forced his way inward, in despite of De Bracy and his followers. Two of the foremost instantly fell, and the rest gave way in despite of their leader's efforts to stop them.
"Dogs!" said De Bracy. "Will you let two win our only pass for safety?" "He is the devil," said a veteran man-at-arms, bearing back from the blows of their sable antagonist.
"And if he be the devil," replied De Bracy, "would you fly from him into the mouth of hell? The castle burns behind us, villains. Let despair give you courage, or let me forward. I will cope with this champion myself."
And well and chivalrously did De Bracy that day maintain the fame he had acquired in the civil wars of that dreadful period. The vaulted passage to which the postern gave entrance, and in which these two redoubted champions were now fighting hand to hand, rung with the furious blows which they dealt each other, De Bracy with his sword, the Black Knight with his ponderous axe. At length the Norman received a blow which, though its force was partly parried by his shield, for otherwise never more would De Bracy have moved limb, descended yet with such violence on his crest that he measured his length on the paved floor.
"Yield thee, De Bracy,"
said the black champion, stooping over him and holding against the bars of his helmet the fatal poniard with which the knights dispatched their adversaries, and which was called the Dagger of Mercy.
"Yield thee, Maurice de Bracy, rescue or no rescue, or thou art but a dead man."
"I will not yield," replied de Bracy faintly, "to an unknown conqueror. Tell me thy name, or work thy pleasure on me. It shall never be said that Maurice de Bracy was prisoner to a nameless churl."
The Black Knight whispered something into the ear of the vanquished.
"I yield me to be true prisoner, rescue or no rescue," answered the Norman, exchanging his tone of stern and determined obstinacy for one of the deepest submission.
"Go to the barbican," said the victor, in a tone of authority, "and there await my further orders.
Yet first, let me say," said De Bracy, "what it imports thee to know. Wilfred of Ivanhoe is wounded and a prisoner, and will perish in the burning castle without present help."
"Wilfred of Ivanhoe," exclaimed the Black Knight, "prisoner and perish? The life of every man in the castle shall answer it if a hair of his head be singed. Show me his chamber.
Ascend yonder winding stair. It leads to his apartment. Wilt thou not accept my guidance?"
"No, to the barbican, and there wait my orders. I trust thee not, De Bracy."
During this combat and the brief conversation which ensued, Cedric, at the head of a body of men, among whom the friar was conspicuous, pushed across the bridge so soon as they saw the postern open, and drove back the dispirited and despairing followers of De Bracy, of whom some asked quarter, some offered vain resistance, and the greater part fled towards the courtyard. De Bracy himself arose from the ground and cast a sorrowful glance after his conqueror.
"He trusts me not," he repeated, "but have I deserved his trust?"
He then lifted his sword from the floor, took off his helmet in token of submission, and going to the barbican, gave up his sword to Locksley, whom he met by the way. As the fire augmented, symptoms of it became soon apparent in the chamber where Ivanhoe was watched and tended by the Jewess Rebecca. He had been awakened from his brief slumber by the noise of the battle, and his attendant was, at his anxious desire, again placed at the window to watch and report to him the fate of the attack, which for some time prevented either from observing the increase of the smouldering and stifling vapour. At length, the volumes of smoke which rolled into the apartment, the cries for water which were heard even above the din of the battle, made them sensible of the progress of this new danger.
"The castle burns," said Rebecca. "It burns. What can we do to save ourselves?"
"Fly, Rebecca, and save thine own life," said Ivanhoe, "for no human aid can avail me."
"I will not fly," said Rebecca.
"We will be saved or perish together. And yet, great God, my father, what will be his fate?"
At this moment the door of the apartment flew open, and the Templar presented himself, a ghastly figure, for his gilded armour was both broken and bloody, and the plume was partly shorn away, partly burned from his casque.
"I have found thee," said he to Rebecca. "Thou shalt prove I will keep my word to share weal and woe with thee. There is but one path to safety. I have cut my way through 50 dangers to point it to thee. Up, and instantly follow me."
"Alone," answered Rebecca, "I will not follow thee.
If thou art born of woman, if thou hast but a touch of human charity in thee, if thy heart be not hard as thy breastplate, save my aged father, save this wounded knight."
"A knight," answered the Templar with his characteristic calmness. A knight, Rebecca, must encounter his fate, whether it meet him in the shape of sword or of flame. And who recks how or where a Jew meets with his?
Savage warrior, replied Rebecca, rather will I perish in the flames than accept safety from thee.
Thou shalt not choose, Rebecca. Once didst thou foil me, but never mortal did so twice.
So saying, he seized on the terrified maiden, who filled the air with her shrieks, and bore her out of the room in his arms, in spite of her cries, and without regarding the menaces and defiance which Ivanhoe thundered against him.
Hound of the Temple! Stain to thine order! Set free the damsel! Traitor of Bois Guilbert, it is Ivanhoe commands thee! Villain, I will have thy heart's blood!
I had not found thee, Wilfred, said the Black Knight, who at that instant entered the apartment, but for thy shouts.
If thou beest true knight, said Wilfred, think not of me. Pursue yon ravisher, save the Lady Rowena, look to the noble Cedric.
In their turn, answered he of the Fetterlock, but thine is first.
And seizing on Ivanhoe, he bore him off with as much ease as the Templar had carried off Rebecca, rushed with him to the postern, and having there delivered his burthen to the care of two yeomen, he again entered the castle to assist in the rescue of the other prisoners. One turret was now in bright flames, which flashed out furiously from window and shot hole. But in other parts, the great thickness of the walls and the vaulted roofs of the apartments resisted the progress of the flames, and there the rage of man still triumphed, as the scarce more dreadful element held mastery elsewhere, for the besiegers pursued the defenders of the castle from chamber to chamber, and satiated in their blood the vengeance which had long animated them against the soldiers of the tyrant Front de Boeuf. Most of the garrison resisted to the uttermost. Few of them asked quarter, none received it. The air was filled with groans and clashing of arms. The floors were slippery with the blood of despairing and expiring wretches. Through this scene of confusion, Cedric rushed in quest of Rowena, while the faithful Gurth, following him closely through the melee, neglected his own safety while he strove to avert the blows which were aimed at his master. The noble Saxon was so fortunate as to reach his ward's apartment just as she had abandoned all hope of safety, and with a crucifix clasped in agony to her bosom, sat in expectation of instant death. He committed her to the charge of Gurth, to be conducted in safety to the Barbican, the road to which was now cleared of the enemy, and not yet interrupted by the flames. This accomplished, the loyal Cedric hastened in quest of his friend Athelstane, determined at every risk to himself to save that last scion of Saxon royalty. But ere Cedric penetrated as far as the old hall in which he had himself been a prisoner, the inventive genius of Womba had procured liberation for himself and his companion in adversity. When the noise of the conflict announced that it was at the hottest, the jester began to shout with the utmost power of his lungs, St. George and the Dragon! Bonny St. George for Merry England! The castle is won! And these sounds he rendered yet more fearful by banging against each other two or three pieces of rusty armour which lay scattered around the hall. A guard, which had been stationed in the outer or ante-room of the old hall, and whose spirits were already in a state of alarm, took fright at Womba's clamour, and, leaving the door open behind them, ran to tell the Templar that foemen had won the old hall. Meanwhile, the prisoners found no difficulty in making their escape into the ante-room, and from thence into the court of the castle, which was now the last scene of contest. Here sat the fierce Templar, mounted on horseback, surrounded by several of the garrison, both on horse and foot, who had united their strength to that of this renowned leader, in order to secure the last chance of safety and retreat which remained to them. The drawbridge had been lowered by his orders, but the passage was beset, for the archers, who had hitherto only annoyed the castle on that side by their missiles, no sooner saw the flames breaking out and the bridge lowered than they thronged to the entrance, as well to prevent the escape of the garrison as to secure their own share of booty ere the castle should be burned down. On the other hand, those of the besiegers who had entered by the postern were now issuing out into the courtyard and attacking with fury the remnant of the defenders, who were thus attacked on both sides at once. Animated, however, by despair, and supported by the example of their indomitable leader, the remaining soldiers of the castle fought with the utmost valour, and, being well armed, succeeded more than once in driving back the assailants, though much inferior in numbers. Rebecca, placed on horseback before one of the Templar's Saracen slaves, was in the midst of the little party, and Bois Guilbert, notwithstanding the confusion of the bloody fray, showed every attention to her safety. Repeatedly he was by her side, and, neglecting his own defence, held before her the fence of his triangular, steel-plated shield, and, anon starting from her side, he cried his war cry, dashed forward, struck to earth the most forward of the assailants, and was in the same instant once more at her bridle rein. Athelstane, who, as the reader knows, was slothful but not cowardly, beheld the female form whom the Templar protected thus sedulously, and doubted not that it was Rowena that the knight was carrying off, in despite of all resistance which could be offered.
"By the soul of St. Edward," he said, "I will rescue her from yonder overproud knight, and he shall die by my hand."
"Think what you do," said Wamba. "The hasty hand catches frog for fish. By my bauble, yonder is none of my Lady Rowena. See but her long dark locks. Nay, and you will not know black from white. You may be leader, but I will be no follower. No bones of mine shall be broken unless I know for whom. And you, without armour, too. Bethink you, silk bonnet never kept out steel blade. Nay, then, if wilful will to water, wilful must drench. Deus vobiscum, most doughty Athelstane," he concluded, loosening the hold which he had hitherto kept upon the Saxon's tunic.
To snatch a mace from the pavement, on which it lay beside one whose dying grasp had just relinquished it, to rush on the Templar's band, and to strike in quick succession to the right and left, levelling a warrior at each blow, was, for Athelstane's great strength, now animated with unusual fury, but the work of a single moment. He was now within 2 paces of Brion de Bois Guilbert, whom he defied in his loudest tone.
"Turn, false-hearted Templar! Let go her whom thou art unworthy to touch! Turn, cursed limb of a band of murdering robbers!" "Dog," said the Templar, grinding his teeth, "I will teach thee to blaspheme the holy order of the Temple of Zion."
And with these words, half wheeling his steed, he made a demi-courbette towards the Saxon, and rising in the stirrups so as to take full advantage of the descent of the horse, he discharged a fearful blow upon the head of Athelstane.
"Well," said Wamba, "that silken bonnet keeps out no steel blade." So trenchant was the Templar's weapon that it shore asunder, as if it had been a willow twig, the tough and plaited handle of the mace, which the ill-fated Saxon reared to parry the blow, and, descending on his head, levelled him with the earth.
"Ha! Beaucion!" exclaimed Bois Guilbert. "Thus be it to the maligners of the Temple Knights!"
Taking advantage of the dismay which was spread by the fall of Athelstane, and calling aloud, "Those who would save themselves, follow me!" he pushed over the drawbridge, dispersing the archers who would have intercepted them. He was followed by his Saracens and some 5 or 6 men-at-arms who had mounted their horses. The Templar's retreat was rendered perilous by the numbers of arrows shot off at him and his party, but this did not prevent him from galloping round to the barbican, of which, according to his previous plan, he supposed it possible De Bracy might have been in possession.
"De Bracy! De Bracy!" he shouted. "Art thou there?"
"I am here," replied De Bracy, "but I am a prisoner."
"Can I rescue thee?" cried Bois Guilbert.
"No," replied De Bracy. "I have rendered me, rescue or no rescue. I will be true prisoner. Save thyself. There are hawks abroad. Put the seas betwixt you and England. I dare not say more."
"Well," answered the Templar, "and thou wilt tarry there. Remember, I have redeemed word and glove. Be the hawks who they will, methinks the walls of the preceptory of Templestowe will be cover sufficient, and thither will I, like heron to her haunt."
Having thus spoken, he galloped off with his followers. Those of the castle who had not gotten to horse still continued to fight desperately against the besiegers after the departure of the Templar, but rather in despair of quarter than that they entertained any hope of escape. The fire was spreading rapidly through all parts of the castle when Ulrika, who had first kindled it, appeared on a turret in the guise of one of the ancient furies, yelling forth a war song such as was of yore chaunted on the field of battle by the scalds of the yet heathen Saxons. Her long, dishevelled grey hair flew back from her uncovered head. The inebriating delight of gratified vengeance contended in her eyes with the fire of insanity, and she brandished the distaff which she held in her hand as if she had been one of the fatal sisters who spin and abridge the thread of human life. Tradition has preserved some wild strophes of the barbarous hymn which she chaunted wildly amid that scene of fire and of slaughter. 1.
Whet the bright steel, sons of the white dragon. Kindle the torch, daughters of Hengist. The steel glimmers not for the carving of the banquet. It is hard, broad, and sharply pointed. The torch goeth not to the bridal chamber. It steams and glitters blue with sulphur. Whet the steel, the raven croaks. Light the torch, Zernebock is yelling. Whet the steel, sons of the dragon. Kindle the torch. Daughters of Hengist.
2.
The black cloud is low over the Thane's castle. The eagle screams. He rides on its bosom. Scream not, grey rider of the sable cloud. Thy banquet is prepared. The maidens of Valhalla look forth. The race of Hengist will send them guests. Shake your black tresses, maidens of Valhalla, and strike your loud timbrels for joy. Many a haughty step bends to your halls, many a helmed head.
3.
Dark sits the evening upon the Thane's castle. The black clouds gather round. Soon shall they be red as the blood of the valiant. The destroyer of forests shall shake his red crest against them. He, the bright consumer of palaces, broad waves he his blazing banner, red, wide, and dusky, over the strife of the valiant. His joy is in the clashing swords and the broken bucklers. He loves to lick the hissing blood as it bursts warm from the wound.
4.
All must perish. The sword cleaveth the helmet. The strong armor is pierced by the lance. Fire devoureth the dwelling of princes. Engines break down the fences of the battle. All must perish. The race of Hengist is gone. The name of Horsa is no more. Shrink not then from your doom, sons of the sword. Let your blades drink blood like wine. Feast ye in the banquet of slaughter by the light of the blazing halls. Strong be your swords while your blood is warm, and spare neither for pity nor fear, for vengeance hath but an hour. Strong hate itself shall expire. I also must perish.
The towering flames had now surmounted every obstruction and rose to the evening skies, one huge and burning beacon seen far and wide through the adjacent country. Tower after tower crashed down with blazing roof and rafter, and the combatants were driven from the courtyard. The vanquished, of whom very few remained, scattered and escaped into the neighbouring wood. The victors, assembling in large bands, gazed with wonder, not unmixed with fear, upon the flames, in which their own ranks and arms glanced dusky red. The maniac figure of the Saxon Ulrika was for a long time visible on the lofty stand she had chosen, tossing her arms abroad with gestures of wild exultation, as if she reigned empress of the conflagration which she had raised. At length, with a terrific crash, the whole turret gave way, and she perished in the flames which had consumed her seducer. An awful pause of horror silenced each murmur of the armed spectators, who for the space of several minutes stirred not a finger save to sign the cross. The voice of Locksley was then heard.
"Shout, yeoman! The den of tyrants is no more! Let each bring his spoil to our chosen place of rendezvous at the trysting tree in the Hart Hill Walk, for there at break of day will we make just partition among our own bands, together with our worthy allies, in this great deed of vengeance."
Chapter 2 Trust me, each state must have its policies. Kingdoms have edicts, cities have their charters. Even the wild outlaw in his forest walk keeps yet some touch of civil discipline. For not since Adam wore his verdant apron hath man with man in social union dwelt, but laws were made to draw that union closer. Old Play. The daylight dawned merrily upon the glades of the oak forest. The green boughs glittered with all their pearls of dew. The hind led her fawn from the covert of high fern to the more open walks of the greenwood, and no huntsman was there to watch or intercept the stately hart as he paced at the head of the antlered herd. The outlaws were all assembled around the trysting tree in the Harthill walk, where they had spent the night in refreshing themselves after the fatigues of the siege, some with wine, some with slumber, many with hearing and recounting the events of the day, and computing the heaps of plunder which their success